Well, good evening, everybody. How's everyone tonight?
Hi.
I'm glad you all can make it out because we have a very special treat. We have Dr. Paul Hahn. He's going to be talking on the subject is fundamental theology, and this is for this is not a one session. This is over six sessions that will be offered. We'll be covering what's on the summary sheet there. Lesson. I have to tell you a little bit about Dr. Hahn. He has his bachelor's and master's degree from Concordia State University, taught English at Northern Illinois. He was working his way north. And then he received his master's degree from the Aquinas Institute of Theology. But then he finally arrived. He was a professional writer for five bishops in Wisconsin and he received his doctorate in theology from Marquette University in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. He's taught at various institutions since then, and he came to the University of St. Thomas in 1990. He's taught courses, he's been here before, and he's always taught courses that have been very well received here. He taught on the Bible and on world religions. He was twice the chair of the theology department at St. Thomas, and he recently retired, so now he can do a lot more of these courses here at the church. He's married, has five children, and nine grandchildren.
The new one was yesterday.
So it is my great honor and my privilege to welcome Dr. Paul Hahn. Good evening, everyone.
Good evening. Let's do a quick prayer, shall we? Father, we give you thanks for revealing yourself to us and for giving to each of us the gift of faith by which we are able to recognize, to accept, and to believe in your revelation. We give our thanks through your Son, Jesus Christ. Amen.
Amen.
Raise your hand if you believe in God. Nobody didn't raise their hand. Everybody in this room believes in God. Why? Why do we believe in God? Well, when I was a little kid, my mom and dad told me God existed. And I suspect that has a lot to do with it for all of us, even us who are on in years. Do you believe in God because of what the Bible says about God? That's a reasonable thing to do. But suppose there was no Bible. Imagine every Bible in the world suddenly disappears and nobody has any remembrance, recollection, concept of a Bible. And imagine that all of the events that are told in the Bible, the Exodus and David and Jesus himself, suppose that those things never happened and nobody has any knowledge of any of those. This is kind of a parallel universe that I'm hypothesizing here. It's obviously not the one that we actually are living in, but just imagine a universe like that. Imagine a universe where God never intervened in the universe. Would you still believe in God? Time for some Jeopardy music. Now, Nisi, you nodded, my dear. So I'll let you say what you were thinking.
I would still God.
Tell me what that means. You don't mean with your fingers, I'm sure. You mean
no,
something internal.
Yeah, I think I would just feel the presence. But if you had never been told there was a God or read it in the Bible, you wouldn't know what that feeling was. How would you know? I think you would intuitively feel it.
You would intuitively know what the feeling was?
I believe so.
You had your hand up.
It's recorded in history that some people that didn't have the Bible or didn't know Jesus, they believed in a supreme being.
Ah, now there's
Native
a good
American?
Point.
Native Americans.
Mayans.
Yeah. You know what the name for God in Native American religions is? Here I'm talking major language group. Watonka. You ever heard of that?
Yeah.
Watonka. That's the name for the supreme God. Now, this is a very interesting point. Even without having revealed himself, it does seem to be the case that a heck of a lot of cultures throughout world history have come to the conclusion that there must be a God. Now, why is that?
But the aliens who came down.
You were doing so well. Yes.
I think when we look at nature and the more we study nature, we can see that it doesn't seem random. It doesn't seem like it comes out of chaos. I mean, the fact that you mathematically continually see the Fibonacci sequence, series as applied to different things and that kind of thing. So it begs the question of why. Why do these things keep coming up? And then, some scientists talk about intelligent design, but it appears as though there's an implication that there is a designer underneath all of creation.
I think you can look around and tell yourself, how could this exist if without a higher supreme being? And I think it's in time, it's developed in time.
It being the concept?
The concept that somehow what we see, there was a creator. And a creator that created all these.
Yeah. Aristotle believed in God. He called God the prime mover. That was his term for God, prime mover. But, interestingly enough, Aristotle believed that just as the universe goes forward infinitely, it will never end, he also thought the universe went backward infinitely, that it never had a beginning. It has just always existed and always will. Now, if you had Aristotle's belief, then wouldn't that throw out what you just referred to, which is the concept of a creator? If the universe was never created at a particular point in time, then why believe in a creator? Aquinas, Thomas Aquinas. Aristotle lived 300 B.C. Aquinas, who lived about 1250 A.D., almost a millennium later. Well, I guess more than a millennium later. He read Aristotle, and he came across this idea of Aristotle's, that the universe exists eternally, both into the past and in the future. But he believes that the universe had a definite beginning. Why did he believe that? Because he was Christian. You read Genesis chapter 1, it says right there, in the beginning the earth was without form and void, and God said, let there be light. And you see the unfolding of the creation. So he knew that Aristotle's idea was incompatible with Christian revelation. So he tried to come up with a reason to disprove Aristotle's belief that the universe was eternal, and he couldn't. never came up with a reason to disprove that. What he came up with instead was something I think is even better. Let's imagine the universe as a sausage roll. You know, you go to Kroger and they got those 2 foot long sausage rolls. That's what this is. Here's the universe moving through time from the past toward the future. Let's select out one single moment out of this time. I don't know, let's pick 7 o'clock tonight, Central Standard Time, as the moment. Here it is right here, this little tiny slice. So we slice that out of the roll, and this is only 1 second of time. Well, even a second includes duration, includes things happening. So let's cut it in half and make it a half second. But that's still got duration. So cut that in half, quarter, an eighth, a 16th, a 32nd. At some point, we're finally going to get down to the point where there's so little time that nothing can change. Aquinas said, even a timeless moment, the universe in a timeless moment, demands an explanation. There's got to be some reason for the universe at any given timeless moment. What do you call these things?
Markers.
Whiteboard marker. Here is a whiteboard marker. Doesn't this whiteboard marker know how to keep itself in existence so that if it lacked the knowledge how to do so, there would be nothing here? No. This is a very stupid whiteboard marker. It does not know how to keep itself in existence. Nor does this pen. Nor does this water glass. Nor does Nancy, bless her heart. Smart woman, but she does not know how to keep herself in existence. A star does not know how to keep itself in existence. Astronomers say that there are, best guess, there are approximately 100 billion galaxies in the universe, and the average galaxy includes 100 billion stars. All of those stars in all of those galaxies are being held in existence by something. They're not holding themselves in existence. If every single item in the universe is incapable of holding itself in existence, then there's no reason to believe that the collectivity, put them all in a big bag, there's no reason to believe the collectivity of the universe knows how to hold itself in existence. So something outside the universe, something transcendent of the universe, is sustaining it. At any given moment, at this moment, right now, we're being held in existence by something other than us. Now that was Thomas Aquinas' argument. He was not arguing that there had to have been. A number of years ago, I asked God to forgive me for all of the artwork depicting him throughout my life. I have to assume he's done so, but at any rate, Aquinas was not arguing about there must be a God because there had to have been a beginning of the universe. He couldn't disprove Aristotle, so he gave up on that one. But his argument was, for any given moment in which anything exists, there has to be something sustaining it. Assuming that thing isn't capable of sustaining itself. So he was not arguing for a temporal dependence. He was arguing for a horizontal dependence. He was arguing for a vertical dependence. If anything exists that is not capable of sustaining itself in existence, then something else has to exist that sustains it in existence. Let me give you three sentences. Three dots in a triangle like that, that's a symbol in logic that means therefore. So, if something exists, God exists. Something does exist, therefore God exists. This is a syllogism. A syllogism is a structure in logic whereby, if the first two statements are true, the third has to be true. If it's a valid syllogism. So the basic structure here is, can you see how my three sentences match that formula? A stands for if something exists. B stands for God exists. If A, then B. If something exists, God exists. A, something exists, therefore God exists. Now, does it have to be true? Is this necessarily a valid syllogism? Well, let's try some others. Use some other things for A and B here. If my wife is dead, then I am a widower. My wife is dead. It worked. If my wife is not dead, then I am not a widower. My wife is not dead, therefore? I am not a widower. So it works. If water is raised above, somebody help me here, 214 Fahrenheit? 212? Above 212 Fahrenheit, it will boil. If water is raised above 212 Fahrenheit, that's A, then it will boil, that's B. In fact, water is now raised above 212. Did it boil?
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Because the syllogism is valid. So long as these two sentences are true, it will always be the case that the conclusion has to be. Everybody agree on this?
Mm-hmm.
So, we know that this structure is valid. The only question is the first statement true? Is the second statement true? If they are, then we've just shown, therefore, God exists. Start with number two, something exists. Is that a true statement? How do you know?
You see it.
Yeah. I mean, that's around. For heaven's sake, right? Of course, it could be possible that what we think are solid three-dimensional objects actually aren't. I mean, couldn't it be the case that everything that you see is actually perceptions in your mind? Can you really prove that what has the characteristics that you interpret as being solid objects outside yourself, can you really prove that they're not just thoughts?
And that's one heck of a good dream.
The Matrix?
I was just thinking of dreams, because when you have dreams, you actually believe, while the dream is occurring, that you're in a reality that includes all kinds of separate three-dimensional objects outside yourself. You can. Sure. The other night I had a dream where I was being chased by somebody. And I finally got to the point where I knew I was going to have to turn around and face him or I was going to drop. So as a last-ditch effort, I turned around. I don't remember who it was. Probably the IRS agent or something. Anyway, I kicked out at him, and I popped awake at just that moment because in actual reality, my leg didn't kick out, and my foot hurt because I hit the wall. So, but even that, a person could argue, the difference between dreams and realities is itself a perception. How do you know everything isn't just thoughts?
lot of Hindus do believe that. They believe that all of reality is just ideas. That's why Hindus who believe that are referred to as idealists, and the philosophy they are embracing is called idealism. Now, this is not the way we normally use the words in English. Idealism usually means a college kid who thinks he's going to change the world and has all kinds of high ideals. But here, in philosophy, the term is used to mean that this is a person who thinks that reality is only ideas. But even then, as you said, even if everything that we perceive is only ideas, and even if there are no three-dimensional objects outside of us, even if that's an illusion, which Hindus call Maya, a delusion, you still got to think something's going on, don't you? You've still got perceptions in existence. So even if there's nothing outside us that exists, something exists. Even if it's just dream vapors or something. There's a position in philosophy. It has been very rarely held, but it does exist as a possible philosophy. It's called solipsism. Solipsism is the position that only you exist. Now, here you are. You, I suspect, I don't know you, so tell me if I'm wrong, but I suspect that you believe that your husband is a really existing entity outside your perceptions. But what if it were the case that none of the rest of us in this room actually exist? In fact, the totality of reality is nothing but one mind's perceptions. Now, I know that her mind is not the only mind in existence because I'm right here inside my head. I can look out and see. Wait a minute. I exist. But she can't prove that. As far as she knows, she's sitting back watching a movie and we're just images on screen. And darned if it isn't hard to prove that that's not the case. It's not an irrational position within among possible philosophical ways of interpreting reality. It is exceedingly self-centered way to interpret reality. That's why I don't know if anybody has ever actually deeply fully believed. Maybe Charles Manson.
Doesn't New Age kind of tend toward that, though?
New Age tends more toward the Hindu kind of position, which is only God exists, and we're all epiphenomena, ideas of God. But, anyway, even in a position like this, extreme as it is, even a solipsist would have to agree that something exists. His own perceptions exist. In all cases, it seems to me, we must admit that sentence number two is true. Even to deny that sentence number two is true creates a denial, which means something exists. We cannot avoid it. So the question is, sentence number one. Is sentence number one true? Something exists in God.
tried to suggest
a proof for earlier this evening when I said that nothing that exists is capable of existing on its own, with one exception, God. So, my proof for the truth of sentence number one is I look at everything that does exist. It seems to me everything that I look at comes to be and crumbles out of existence and comes to be and crumbles out of existence and comes to be and crumbles out of existence. Nothing seems capable of holding itself in existence. So, if individuals cannot, the collectivity cannot, therefore there has to be dependence of the universe at any given moment in time on something else. And that something else we call God.
Do the true selves kind of believe that they are God?
I ever meet one? That's a good question.
I mean, certainly, though, then you would have to ask them, I guess, how do they hold themselves in existence following that?
Yeah.
And if they can't answer that, then the question would be that they must also not know how to do that.
Well, let's just speculate here. Suppose that I'm a solipsist, that I genuinely believe that none of you actually exist, that everything I ever see is my own perceptions, and no other perceptions exist. That's the totality of reality. Could I still believe in the Hindu option, which is that each of us is actually God, who is deluded into thinking that we're not God. And the purpose of life is to rediscover that we are God. They call God Brahman, B-R-A-H-M-A-N, ground of all being and non-being. And according to them, Brahman, perhaps out of boredom, they don't usually give any motive, but Brahman hid himself from himself and created this illusory reality that we are all caught in. And each of us is Brahman striving to rediscover that we're God. And Hindus who have had that kind of breakthrough experience where they suddenly realize that they're God claim that the illusory character of reality suddenly becomes a plane. And they realize that only Brahman exists. If I were a solipsist and I claimed that none of you exist, only my perceptions exist, I could still maybe argue that I am God who does not yet know it. I'm just speculating. It's a good question.
Doesn't that term kind of describe that?
What term?
That all his thoughts hold us in place. I mean, without his thinking of us, I mean, isn't that true?
It's true that if this syllogism is true, and the whole universe depends on God at every single moment of its existence, then if God were ever, for a moment, to cease to think of us, we would slip out of existence. Right? Is that what you're thinking of? I like to think of this like a mirror. If I held up a mirror to the universe, so that there's a reflection of the universe here, if I whipped my hand down, what would happen to the universe in the mirror? It would just disappear. It's kind
kind of that way, if God ever were to withdraw for a second his will to sustain us all in existence, this room would be empty. No, it wouldn't, because there wouldn't be any room. There'd be nothing. Now, there's an interesting concept. Nothing. What is nothing like? I usually, when I try to imagine nothing, I start with outer space. You know, here's a big, big black volume in which are sprinkled these little twinkly stars and galaxies and such. And when I think of nothing, I imagine swiping everything in outer space out of existence. Does that result in nothing?
No.
No, because you've still got the big black space. You've still got space. So, collapse all of space down into a tiny point until it poof, disappears. Do you now have nothing? No, because now you've got kind of gray walls where space used to be. We are incapable of imagining true nothingness. No thingness. Absolute nothing. Okay, you're batting 1,000 again. That was a good one. We Christians maintain, it's one of our beliefs, that at the beginning there was nothing except the one necessary being, the one being that cannot not be, and that's God. And God because he loved sausage, caused there to become the universe moving forward through time. That's what we nowadays refer to as the Big Bang. How do we know there was a Big Bang? In 1963, a couple of scientists in, I want to say Baltimore, somewhere on the East Coast, they created a radio telescope. It was a telescope that would not collect light waves, it would collect radio waves. They wanted to see what was the top four then among the aliens, right? So they turned it on, and they heard this very low-level hum. And they knew that wasn't supposed to be. So they cleaned it all and turned it on, still got this low-level hum. They thought it was the pigeons pooping on it. Seriously, that's honestly what they thought. But they realized it couldn't be that, they got all the pigeon poop off. Finally, they came to the conclusion that this is... See if that's for me, would you? They finally came to the conclusion that this was a very faint cosmic microwave noise. And they discovered that it did not matter where they pointed their radio telescope, in all directions this noise was coming in. This became one of the best proofs for the Big Bang Theory. Up until that time, there were alternate theories, like steady-state theory and so on. But from that time forward, we pretty much accepted that, yes, indeed, just like Christian Revelation has always said, there was a moment at which the first moment existed, at which time itself began. Um,
even remember what point I was making with this.
So that little beep sound will last forever?
Yeah. Well, as long as the universe does.
Okay.
My point was, for 2,000 years, Christians have believed in creatio ex nihilo, creation out of nothing. And lo and behold, 20 centuries later, science seems to have shown that that's the case. Somebody had a hand up. Yes, sir.
It was actually a Catholic priest in 1932 who came up with that conversation. He's an astronomer. He's a Belgian astronomer and priest.
I'll be darned. I wasn't aware of that. Very cool. You don't remember his name?
No.
Your homework assignment for next week.
I'll bring it in.
Bring us that name. Yeah, that's very cool. Good. Fred Hoyle was the astronomer who argued
right.
for the steady state.
Well,
the opposite.
But it was Hoyle who discovered that the universe was constantly expanding, which then led to the concept it had to start with.
Big Bang, yeah. Right.
And outside, it's Hubble.
Oh, yes. In the 1920s.
Yes.
Right. Isn't it amazing to think that nobody even knew galaxies existed? Until Hubble in the 1920s. Everybody thought that everything out there was a single star because we couldn't magnify them enough to see. I mean, that's like 100 years, less than 100 years. It's amazing. Anyway, creation out of nothing. If we can really, we cannot imagine nothingness. In other words, we cannot have an image of nothingness. But we can understand the concept of nothingness. So let's consider nothingness. Absolute, total, no-thing-ness. Including God. Absolute nothingness. Could anything ever come into existence out of absolute nothingness? If there's nothing there, there's nothing that can cause anything ever to come into existence, right? You cannot get something from nothing. So really, the ultimate question for me has always been, why is there something rather than sheer nothing? Why is there anything at all? And that forces me to believe in God. There had to have been something in order for there to be something. Well, I began this evening by saying, imagine that we got rid of the Bible, all the interventions by God throughout history. There never was an incarnation, no Jesus. On what basis could we nevertheless believe in God? And as you people said, nature, by which I mean not just flowers and trees as opposed to buildings and such, I mean everything that exists, seems to me to be a reason to believe in God. Well, and here's my proof for it. This is not my proof, by the way. This is one of Aquinas' five evidences for the existence of God, as can be found in his
Summa Theologica. This one, which I think is the best, has traditionally been referred to as the cosmological argument for the existence of God. Cosmological because cosmos is the Greek word for universe. So it's the argument for the existence of God based upon the fact of the universe. If something exists, God exists. If something does exist, therefore God exists. We as Catholics include within our belief system the idea that one can infer the existence of God even without God having intervened in creation. Just from the sheer brute fact of creation itself, it's possible for a human being to infer God's existence. In fact, there is physical basis for holding this belief that one can know that God exists and know something of him just from creation itself. I'm thinking here of Romans chapter 1, verse 19 and 20. Romans 1, 19 and 20. What can be, this is Paul, what can be known about God is evident. Because God made it evident to us, it says to them, but it's to everybody. What can be known about God is evident because God has made it evident to us. Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes of eternal power and divinity have been able to be understood and perceived in what he has made. Isn't that what we've been arguing in the last 45 minutes? Ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes and eternal power of eternal power and divinity have been able to be understood and perceived in what he has made. That's exactly what this is arguing here. So Paul, although I doubt if he had ever worked out, you know, the kind of logical reasoning that Aquinas had done later, but still, he's got it in nuce, in nut form, this basic idea that we can know something about God just from nature itself. Let's use as a term for knowing God this way, let's use the term natural revelation. The word revelation comes from the verb to reveal, and I checked this afternoon in Merriam-Webster's. It turns out that reveal comes from the word veil, like a woman wears a veil. So what revelation means is to reveal something, to disclose something that's otherwise hidden. Is it accurate to say that by nature, and nature here I mean creation, all of creation, is it accurate to say that God is hidden? Didn't we just read that it's evident to all from the fact of creation that God exists, or should be? Well, it still is something that has to be revealed.
because when you were just born, like my ninth grandson is now 15 hours old, plus 9 months, okay, but still, I doubt very much if he's pondering whether that's an accurate, valid syllogism or not. He hasn't thought about whether the fact that something exists proves that God must exist. He will someday. Even if he never, works it out explicitly, if something exists, God exists, something exists, or God exists, as most of us hadn't done it prior to tonight. But all of you, like Nisi said, you got this kind of gut instinct. You realize deep inside there must be some kind of God. There's something more than just what we see. So I think it is reasonable to refer to this as revelation, because it does have to become known to us at some point in our lives. We have to recognize that creation itself gives us some inkling about God. Can we say more than just inkling? Can we be more specific? Well, God's existence, right? Creation allows us to infer that God exists. Is there anything else that we can infer about God on the basis of the effect of which he is the cause?
Well, the holy longing. I think all of us have just a
super.
I mean, no matter what you believe or not, that longing for something that's beyond you, or whatever you want to call it.
That sounds a lot like what Nietzsche was talking about. Do you know her, by the way?
Yeah. After a while, we
don't know. Now, doesn't that?
It's a holy longing.
Exactly. Isn't it true that God has chosen to create a universe in which its highest creature, so far as we know, desires a personal relationship with the Creator? For God to have implanted that within us suggests, maybe not, doesn't prove, but at least suggests that he too would like a personal relationship with us. Why else would he do it, except maybe to be cruel? And that's a possibility. If we're talking simply what could be inferred by reason alone,
it's driven many people mad.
But it does seem to suggest that God is loving. And even for God to have created something else with himself, you have to ask, why did that happen? Couldn't God, prior to the Big Bang, have remained God prior to the Big Bang? He could have never caused a Big Bang. He could have caused a universe never to come into existence. So why did he? He was bored. He wanted to see some twinkling lights. That's not the reason Christianity suggests. It's because he is so full of love that he wanted to share existence. There's a term in theology for not just loving, but all loving. Omni benevolence. Volente is like voluntary. It's a Latin word for will. And bene is good. So, omne bene volente means all good willing. He never wills anything but good. Exactly. Go ahead. But why might one come to that conclusion? We've all seen evil. And that is a part of existence, isn't it? So that brings into question whether or not God is all loving. The problem of evil, this is not a syllogism, it's just a set of three statements. The problem of evil can be summarized in three sentences. God is omnibenevolent. We know what that means. He's all loving. God is omnipotent, which means all powerful. Omni still means all, potent and powerful. So God is all powerful. There's the problem of evil. How do we reconcile these three sentences? If God is all loving, he will not want evil to exist. If God is all powerful, he can cause evil not to exist, and yet evil exists. That's the problem.
That's where the idea of free will came in, I guess. But then, that's our problem.
Not true. This is an interesting issue and one we could discuss at another time, but it's outside the scope of our discussion at the moment. There is some evidence to conclude that God is omnibenevolent, but there's also contradictory evidence which might prompt one not to accept that as an aspect of God that we can infer from creation itself. What about omnipotence? Can we infer that God is omnipotent from the fact of creation? I think you may as well. Given 100 billion galaxies, each of which has 100 billion stars in it, it makes me think of one of those guys on stage that juggles, and he takes a stick and puts a plate on top and spins it, and then he sets it on his foot, and then he takes another and spins it and puts it on his back, and he winds up with all these spinning plates. That's kind of like God, you know, with all these spinning universes, or excuse me, spinning galaxies through the universe. One could argue that it's not, you can't prove that it's all powerful, just very, 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 very powerful. But what's the difference really between this and this? You know, you may as well go ahead and say all powerful. And I think that's what Paul was talking about when he said, ever since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes of eternal power and divinity have been able to be understood and perceived by what he had made. Power is explicitly referred to there by Paul. I'm not sure what he means by divinity, unless he means cause, contingent cause of the universe, which is what we were arguing. So maybe teach after that as well, I don't know. But,
well, here is the lady concept notion of whether you want to devil get into this under the about it always, that's always presented what is the devil fit into this using your own time if you want to this place, this our place.
Yeah. Christianity has always assumed, I don't know if it's ever been defined or not, but it's traditional teaching that the creation of the angels occurred at the beginning, at the same moment as, or infinitesimal moment prior to the coming into existence of the material universe. And actually, that raises an interesting speculation. I said I wasn't going to get into the problem of evil, but now you've asked, so here we go. Does God respect your free will?
Yes.
If you decide that you want to rob a bank, will God stop you from doing that? He could, absolutely. But he doesn't. He respects our free will. He allows us to make our own choices. So, since he respects human free wills sufficiently to allow us to make evil choices, could he not also respect angelic free wills to make bad choices? And what do you call bad angelic wills? Demons. There's angels who opt for God, and there are demons who opt against him. God must immensely value free will, because God allows horrific human free will choices to be made. Hitler and the Jews. 6 million Jews dead because of human free will choice in a 6-year period. Hitler in World War II, 55 million people dead in a 6-year period. We can explain evils that are caused by human free will. Let's refer to those as moral evils, by saying God immensely respects free will, so much so that he's willing to allow our evils to exist that result from our free will choices. But are there not evils in the universe that are not caused by you and me? Cancer.
Yeah, the big tobacco companies persuaded everybody to smoke, and they wound up with tons of cancers as a result. But cancer in and of itself pre-existed tobacco and so on. So there does seem to be evils that exist that are not the result of human free will choices. March of last year, tsunami off the northeast coast of Japan. How many died? 2,600. 24 hours later, 2,600 people gone. These were beloved grandfathers and grandmothers and aunts and uncles and parents with children now bereft, etc. Who chose that? Wasn't him, wasn't me. That wasn't a human free will choice, and yet evil resulted, orphans and so on. Let's refer to things like this, tsunamis, volcanoes, earthquakes, etc., as natural evil. So far as we know, there are three types of free will in existence, in reality, in the universe. God has free will. Humans have free will. And angels
have free wills, including bad angels. So, if you're one of those who wants to get rid of the concept of angels and demons as some kind of medieval, archaic nonsense, then you've got exactly two choices upon whom you can blame natural evils. Either humans did it, which we already know is not the case, that's how we define natural evil, not caused by humans, or God did it. Do you want to attribute evil to God? No. Consequently, I blame natural evils on humans. But that doesn't mean that I think some bat-like creature was hovering up in the atmosphere above Japan in March of last year and pointed a finger and caused a tsunami. What I'm suggesting is, if it's true that angels came into existence just as the material universe is coming into existence, and if at that first moment they existed, some chose for God, some chose against him, that's traditional Catholic teaching, then couldn't it be that evil angels could have deformed the universe as it came into existence? Now, that posits the idea of pretty darn powerful angels. But isn't it awfully self-centered of us to think that angels are basically us with wings? I think angels may very well be immensely more powerful, unbelievably more powerful than we, in which case, in the same way that God so valued free will in humans that he allows evils like Nazis and so on, could it not be that God so values free will in angels that he allows their evil choices to manifest themselves in the universe? Does that make sense? Anybody lost? I was not going to talk about this tonight, but he made me.
If nothing was damaged, would they still consider evil? For example, if the tsunami that hit, the earthquake tsunami hit Japan, and Japan was not populated in that area, no structures existed, the same natural phenomena occurred, but is that evil?
Well, then a question there would be, are we to define evil as only stuff that we humans don't like? According to scientific research, the Big Bang occurred 13.7 billion years ago. And since then, various stars came into existence, galaxies, so on. Our solar system came into existence 4.6 billion years ago. Life on Earth came into existence about 3.5 billion years ago. At first, it was just amoebas and bacteria and so on. But ultimately, vertebrates, fish, amphibians, mammals, reptiles, etc. We, humans, we only showed up about 100,000 years ago. And even if you want to include Neanderthals as humans, which technically science does, they showed up about 250,000 years ago. Here is the genus, here is the genus Homo sapiens, of which there are two types. Homo sapiens Neanderthalensis and Homo sapiens sapiens. Neanderthals were kind of like the cavemen, you know, if we're thinking. Homo means like us. Sapiens means smart. Sapientia is Latin for wisdom. So they're like us, they're wise, but they're Neanderthals. Or they're like us, they're wise, and they're very wise. Meaning us. We're the very wise. We only show up 100,000 years ago. Even Neanderthals, assuming they're humans, showed up 250,000 years ago. That means we got a period here of life on Earth about 3.5 billion years without any humans on it. Was there no evil?
That's where you come in with chaos.
Nature, to quote Tennyson, nature is red in tooth and claw. Everything's chewing on everything else. The Tyrannosaurus Rex kills the Brontosaurus. The bat, an insectivore, eats mosquitoes. That's evil for the mosquitoes. So if we think of evil that way, it's not just from our perspective, but deprivation of good from any perspective.
Are
you saying that good is order? Are you saying philosophy is disorder? Oh, you got me there. I don't know. I'd have to think about it. Do I want to argue that all evils are entropy? The tendency toward chaos? I don't know. That's too much for me.
Well, I mean, you study black holes, they look pretty evil. I wouldn't want to meet one. I mean,
true.
The universe is rather chaotic, I mean, scientists.
And it keeps moving toward chaos.
Right.
Entropy, what is that third law of thermodynamics? What is that thing? How does that go? It's the second law. How's it go? What's it say?
It goes from an order to without all that energy, it goes to disorder to chaos.
Yeah. That seems built into the universe.
Well,
who built it into the universe? If there's only three types of free will in the world, and we humans didn't do it, we weren't even around, it's got to be God or angels. And I, for one, am not going to attribute people to God. Yeah?
I always compartmentalize it and you blame, like you say, the angels and demons on the natural evil, more or less, like, you know, unaffected by humans, the evils that are unaffected by humans, and God would create or allow trials to for us. And so I would say that, like you were saying, the example of a tsunami, I would categorize that as more of a trial than a evil.
There's a book in the Old Testament, Book of Job, which takes that view that the trials Job endures are intended by God as a way of hopefully strengthening Job's faith. The conclusion that the Book of Job draws, however, is not that that premise is true. Here's what the Book of Job ultimately says about the problem of evil. This is Job chapter 38. The Lord addressed Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Where were you when I founded the earth? Who determined its size? Do you know? Who stretched out the measuring line for it? Into what were its pedestals sunk? While the morning stars sang in chorus and all the sons of God shouted for joy. Who shut within doors the sea when it burst forth from the womb? When I made the clouds its garment, and thick darkness its swathing bands. When I set limits for it, and fastened the bar of its door, and said, thus far shall you come, but no farther, and here shall your proud waves be stilled. Have you ever in your lifetime commanded the morning, and shown the dawn its place? Have you entered into the sources of the sea, or walked about in the depths of the abyss? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you comprehended the breadth of the earth, and so on and so on and so on? All of which are rhetorical questions on God's part, the point of which is, you don't know nothing. You're a dinky little human mind trying to comprehend why things are the way they are, and you can't know what I know. People think that when they die, everything will be explicit, everything will be understood. I don't think that's the case. I think that when we're dead, we're going to be dead human beings. We'll still be limited in our mental abilities. For us, even after death, when granted we'll understand a heck of a lot more than we do now, even after death, for us to try to comprehend what God comprehends is like trying to put the entire ocean into a teacup. We can't do it. So the point that the author of Job is making is we don't know the answer, ultimately. We can theorize, you know, why is there evil, and all that stuff. But ultimately, we really have to have faith. The last thing Job says, after hearing this comeuppance from God, is, Job answered the Lord and said, I know that you can do all things, and that no purpose of yours can be hindered. I have dealt with great things that I do not understand, things too wonderful for me, which I cannot know. I had heard of you by word of mouth, but now my eye has seen you. Therefore, I disown what I have said, and I repent in dust and ashes. In that little statement there, Job says, I had heard of you by word of mouth, but now, my eye has seen you. That's an interesting statement. Hearing is the second strongest sense for humans. Our strongest sense is sight, right? For a dog, smell is the strongest sense. And sight is actually rather weak. They only see shades of brown. For us, though, we see more vividly, more accurately, more precisely than we hear. So he says, I had heard of you, but now I see you. The implication is, I think he's talking about mystical experience, basically. He's talking about a direct, non-sensory contact with God. Now, an experience like that is not part of natural revelation. An experience like that, it's up to God to decide whether it will occur or not. Some people in the church throughout history have mystical experiences all the time. We refer to them as mystics.
And by mystical experience, I mean direct, non-sensory contact with God. St. Teresa of Avila, for example, had them very frequently. I've only had one in my entire life. It happened when I was 25. And it only lasted for a split second. It was 2 or 3 in the morning. I was single at the time, laying in my apartment, reading a philosopher named Heidegger, reading his concepts on being, actually. And all at once, something happened. It's like the fault lines in California become more and more tense and then let go, right? It's like a silent earthquake occurred. I still don't know exactly what happened. But the moment after this experience, I felt a contact with God. And I had a experience of God that I could look back upon for the rest of my life as a kind of touchstone. And emotionally, I was ecstatic. It took about 6 months before I finally came back down to normal, ordinary reality. Now, such an experience as that is not that uncommon. I've asked classes of students down at the university on occasions, very different semesters, and there's always several students that have had an experience like that. Has anybody here had an experience like that? Is that what you were thinking of back at the beginning of tonight when you said a feeling? Ah, what was yours like, if you don't mind my asking?
It was after my son died. And I was meditating and I was asking God to show me where he was and how to get in touch with him. And all of a sudden, I thought complete communication with God. He was right there. And instead of asking him where my son, I said, is it true about you?
Well, I've got you on the phone.
That's exactly
about
what I'm saying. I know I've
heard
it, and I know that he was and I was brought up with a lot of religion, a lot of friends through Jewish, so I had a lot to choose from. And I always believed in about Jesus, but I wanted to make absolute sure. While I had him on the line, instead of asking about my son, I said, tell me about Jesus. And he said, yes, that is true.
Yeah.
That was an enormous experience.
Oh, and wasn't it consoling?
Yes.
Ah.
Yes. I lost all fear after that.
You just feel surrounded by a presence.
It's a different conversion that you took to point.
Well, that was my conversion experience. That was I had been born and raised Methodist until I was 17, at which time I declared to my mother, "Forget it, ain't going to church no more. I'm an atheist," which I really wasn't, but I liked to bother her. So it was not until 8 years later, when I'm 25. That I even start to ask religious questions again. Why do I exist? Is there a God? And so on. And then I had this experience. And that prompted me to investigate the Catholic Church, and I converted to Catholicism. The conversion experience that you're talking about is not to one denomination of Christianity or another. It's to God. And that was my conversion experience. I don't know if conversion experiences always have to be that dramatic.
Paul had one. Mm-hmm.
True.
He got struck by lightning and knocked off his horse.
Two problems with that statement. Number one, it doesn't refer to lightning. And number two, it doesn't refer to a horse.
Right. He got struck by something.
He got struck. We don't know that. But I bring this up because a mystical experience, a direct non-sensory contact with God, is a different kind of revealing of himself than occurs by reason
speculating or thinking about nature. So we can add to the fact of natural revelation what we can call supernatural revelation. Super means above, so beyond what's given with nature or creation, God can still reveal himself.
I think that was what this prayer behind was referring to earlier, asking that God could reveal himself through your trials. And the answer is that God can reveal himself through anything. That's right. It's still supernatural.
Yeah. Simply by the fact that he created creation. And that's what we call supernatural revelation, and that's where we'll start next time.
Thank you.